Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to a very special end-of-year roundup of Section D. Over 12 months and 52 shows, we've covered a lot of ground in the world of design. We've boarded planes, trains and automobiles, quizzing their designers on the way, to attend fairs, festivals and vernissage from Chicago to Christchurch, Kyoto to Cape Town, Madrid to Maracaibo. We've waded through water at boat shows, struggled through sawdust in workshops the world over. We've donned a hard hat or two, dressed down for construction sites, dressed up for fashion shows, and borrowed recording studios in San Francisco, New York, Zurich, Milan, Tokyo, and Sydney to deliver the goods each week. It's been a whirl, a ball, a blast, and a bang all at the same time. Over the next hour, we'll be dipping into our best bits from all 52 shows. Coming up, we'll wind back the clock to some of the events we covered live, from the Biennale in Venice to the fashion graduation in Antwerp and the Salone del Mobile in Milan, of course.
The technology around making things these days, I mean, digital in the past 20 years has completely revolutionised how we communicate.
We'll revisit some of the great names we spoke to, from Richard Rogers to James Dyson.
We make hundreds of thousands of things every day, and it's fascinating and very, very exciting.
And some of the more humorous opinions too.
How much ugliness do we need? I mean, should there be laws to promote ugliness? Should there be a quota? Because it's absolutely certain we need a certain ugliness in order to enjoy beauty.
And we'll relive some of our finer themed shows too, which have seen us tackle design and healthcare, publishing, education, and even religion. More on all these, plus a sprinkling of our most favourite packages from throughout the year too. That's all to come over the next hour in our end-of-year roundup of the very best of Section D 2012. Stay tuned. And what better place to start than at the biggest event on the annual design calendar, the Salone del Mobile in Milan. Back in April, we decamped a sizeable team to Italy's commercial capital and made our home in the studios of Il Sole 24 Ore. For four consecutive mornings, we dragged a succession of the design world's finest thinkers from their beds to join us over coffee and debate the future of the design industry live on Monocle 24. The standout exhibition of the week-long fair was called The Future in the Making. Rather than a show of new furniture, it explored the future of the funding, production and commercial models of the design industry. Curated by Domus magazine, the Venerable Titles young editor Joseph Greimer explained more on Section D, Episode 28.
The title of the exhibition, The Future in the Making, is a clear nod to the maker movement, to all of the transformations that are impacting the technology around making things these days. I mean, digital in the past 20 years has completely revolutionized how we communicate. And now there's a sea change also in its impact on the manufacturing process. And of course, this here in Milan being a place which is, especially during the Salone del Mobile, a massive showcase of incredibly beautiful things, it's inevitable that sooner or later one has to start to consider how these things are made and how digital technologies are actually going to transform them, not just from the point of view of their appearance, and but also their functionality and the economics, the economic models behind them. So the future in the making is really an attempt to actually kind of dig into this and to present what we call a kind of an archipelago of open design archipelago, an archipelago of ideas, individuals who are working on this idea, kind of trying to inject new models, new processes, new approaches to design through, I'd say, a dozen different projects that we're grouping
together.
Tell us
a little bit about one or two of the projects that are in
Well, we have the first thing you'll see when you enter the Palazzo Clerici, I should say. It's one of the most beautiful
Baroque... Clerici, sorry, I said Clerici.
No, it's those Italian phonetics.
It's the C's, they always trip me up.
Exactly. The Palazzo Clerici is it's an incredibly beautiful 17th century palazzo, Tiepolo, frescoes on the ceiling and so on. We chose it as precisely for this contrast between the kind of technological future and the artigianale, they say, the past of the great Italian masters. So when you enter the ballroom, for example, you're confronted with a soda cinta machine, which is a project by RCA graduate Marcus Kaiser. He designed and built this incredible machine that looks like a Mars rover, which he took out into the Moroccan desert. And he actually used it to focus. It has a very large array of solar collectors that focus a beam of very intense light on a small bed of sand. And this is connected to a small processor, a pre-programmed processor, that actually moves the beam around, transforming it into a solar printer, 3D solar-powered printer. So it's actually a 3D printer that operates in the middle of a desert and transforms sand into bowls or other small items.
That was Joseph Grima talking to me there during the Salone del Mobile in Milan on Section D, Episode 28. To hear the interview and the whole show in full, visit monocle.com. Or alternatively, you can download each show from iTunes too. The Salone wasn't the only event we covered this year. For Section D35, Gillian de Bias boarded the train to Antwerp, where she attended the Fashion Academy's glittering graduation shows. Here's Gillian with Walter van Berendonk, the Fashion Department Director.
I think that Antwerp Academy, the fashion school, has a very specific vision, because as long as I remember, I graduated here, I came back very quickly after 3 years, I started to teach. And what for us is extremely important is the very individual approach. So we work very individual with the students, we give them the possibility to learn and work with a very strong signature. And we really don't want them to adapt themselves to a certain system or to be very flexible to be in the fashion world. No, that we really try to make very strong individuals, and then afterwards, of course, they can adapt them. We definitely try to push them and try to push their boundaries, because what I really enjoy to teach, and what I think of one of my strengths is that I have a very huge fantasy and I can easily get into the heads of the students. And it's not that I try to change their vision, no, I just want to broaden their vision. And one of the things which is extremely important for us is that it's that also are aware of the contemporary world, what it's going on. We push them to look around, we push them to look to art and to be interested in a lot of different topics. And from that point of view out, we push them and we try to broaden their world. And that results then in more interesting collections. Fashion is a strong communicator, and we really see fashion as a kind of communication. Also, one of the visions of the Antwerp School is that you can tell stories through your collections and what you are making. And that, again, it can be a very individual story that you're telling. And we definitely believe in the power of fashion one way or another. And of course, we also want that from the students, that they go further than just making clothes. We want them to tell it and to show it and to communicate through it. And then it can be all different types of statements and visions, and you can tell anything you want through fashion. The students changed, but also time changed a lot. And if I'm thinking back to the 80s, which was like an incredible explosion of fashion, what was happening with at the time in Paris with French designers, Gautier, Mugler, Montana, and then afterwards the Japanese designers arriving there, like Kawakubo and Yoshi Yamamoto. It was an incredible moment of fashion in general, and it was also like a kind of euphoria which was going on at that time. We know the world changed, economic situations changed, communication changed, and we try to introduce it and we try to attract their attentions also on these facts, but in fact it's not the most important for us. This cocoon thing is there and the world is around, and from time to time the world gets in, but they have the possibility to stay in the cocoon. I think it was very obvious on the catwalk that there are at the moment two contrasts very obviously there. It's like one side you have this romantic fantasy feeling, and the other side has a very clear aggression. And aggression which can be reflected through pamphlets that are reacting and also sex and using certain elements in the collections. But these two elements are there very obviously. And I think it's definitely reflecting the world also.
That was Section D's producer Gillian de Bias with director of the Antwerp Fashion Academy, Walter van Berendonk, there for Section D, Episode 35. Come August, we escaped Olympic fever in London for a bit of a breather and headed to Venice for the 13th Architecture Biennale. First-time participants Angola, away from the main body of exhibitions, stole the show for me with a plant called Arundodonax. Here's me discussing the show with the Angolan curators Stefano Raboli Pansera and Paola Nascimento.
Well, this is the island of San Giorgio Maggiore in Venice. It was designed, the church was designed by Palladio. There is a beautiful cloister close to us and is a place full of history. We wanted to copy a fragment of Kazenga, the area of investigation in Luanda, inside the room, the Sala Carnelutti, where we are, and we didn't want to touch anything of the existing. And this is part of our sensibility, because we want really to change everything by changing nothing. And the idea is that we rebuild a one-to-one scale prototype of our intervention in Kazenga, in Venice.
And what does that consist of? Because you say that you built a one-on-one scale prototype, but there's no buildings here. We're actually standing in what looks like a very beautiful garden.
We rebuilt the footprint of the buildings, which are actually the void, and we focused on the common ground, which for us is this energetic garden that morphs its function and also its role within the city. It's basically a garden composed of a certain type of plants, Arundodonax, that perform several functions in the city. They have thin roots and they filter dirty water. They grow 1 meter a month and they can be cropped and transformed into biomass. And ideally, the people that have these gardens or that will have these gardens could crop their own plants and then sell the plants or sell the energy or produce their own energy.
So it's an amazing solution that seems incredibly simple for raising the quality of life of the inhabitants of Luanda, because Luanda is not known necessarily for its quality of life at the moment. How feasible is this that it could be implemented?
The proposal is very feasible. I would like to say that the common ground becomes a shared resource for the city, because the space in between the building provides the sewage and the electricity for each family that lives in the neighborhood. This is a proposal which is very feasible. The technology that we propose has already been implemented in other African countries and even outside Africa. Our contribution consists in the fact that we offer a critique to the typology of the garden, which is not really leisure, but is a garden and infrastructure simultaneously.
That was Stefano Raboli Pansera and Paola Nascimento, curators of the Angolan Pavilion at the 13th Venice Architecture Biennale. That's from Section D, Episode 48. If you've just joined us, you're listening to an end-of-year Best of Section D special, where we're dipping into our 52-hour archive to bring you the highlights from our year on the road. Still to come, we'll hear from Richard Rogers and Stephen Bailey. We'll be dissecting the design community of Cape Town and Madrid. And we'll talk books with Dutch book designer Irma Boom, too, after this short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to our best of the best of an entire year of Section D. Some of our finest shows took one theme and explored it across the different disciplines of design. We covered a wide range of topics, from design and healthcare to design and education and food. But one of my favourites was back in Section D, Episode 13, where we delved into the world of design and publishing. And who better to visit than the wonderful Dutch book designer Irma Boom?
For me, it's not just turning the pages. It's more than turning the pages. It's
It's the edges, it's the way the book falls open, it's the smell, it's the tactility. And working now as a book designer is extremely interesting because of internet and iPad.
I can see we've got the Think book here, which is your five-year project, which is absolutely huge and a beautiful book. Perhaps you can talk us through it.
It's a book in collaboration with Jan Pijnappel, art historian, and me, and our commissioner, Mr. Paul Ventener van Vlissingen of SHV Holdings. It's a multinational based in the Netherlands. It used to be a coal trading company. And he said, can my company exist, our family-owned company exist in 1996, 100 years, and I want to have something unusual. Can you do this? That was in 1991, he asked. So carte blanche, we could do whatever we liked. And so the only thing he told us, make something unusual. The book was clear it will never be for sale. So it's for shareholders. And you can only be born as a shareholder. And every time when a shareholder becomes 18, he or she will get a book.
How do you start designing a book like this?
If you do a book like this, then it's not about designing a book. It's more the idea, the vision. So the book ends in 1799 and starts in 1996. So it goes back in time. But we don't have any chapters. We don't have page numbers. And so with these specific events, you can tell a story about the company. And the book has no articulation in text, so all the text is basically sort of body text. So you have to read and spend time with the book to understand it. And to help you a bit, we have to introduce case studies. We have questions like, what do you learn from mistakes? Why did you get up this morning? Why do you shake hands? Questions like that, so that you get curious. 2,136 pages has paper, which is my own recipe. I only, and a paper maker, know it. It has, if you put it in specific light, things appear. The book has a stainless steel spine, so it lays open very beautifully. On the fore edge, there's a tulip field, but if the book is closed, there's a poem. It has a wonderful watermark in it with the corporate philosophy of the company, because a corporate philosophy you should not print, it's something you should feel.
So it's really, it's a personal investment for you.
Oh yes, it is. I think it is, of course. Yeah, and if I do something, I cannot do it half. It's very well photographed. It's very well printed, it's very well bound, this book. And basically what I did was putting on the right page 100 of her miniatures. And I always ask Sheila, can you write a text for it? Can you describe it? I got this idea to give the book on the top left and bottom side a sort of specific edge. And it looks almost like a weaving. And every book is unique, like all her textiles are unique. And then we had the problem, if you have a book with all these colorful weavings and this wonderful edge, what do you put on the cover? I didn't want to put anything on the cover. I thought the book as the object. That it should look like this container of thoughts and images. And the moment you open it, suddenly it reveals. Then you see the beauty.
That was Dutch book designer Irma Boom there divulging the secrets of her extraordinary craft on episode 13 of Section D. For episode 31, Monocle's creative director Richard Spencer Powell was joined in the studio by author Michael Evermy to discuss the rebranding of churches.
Is the church in a crisis? Does it need a rebrand? Perhaps why does it need a rebrand?
I think the church as a whole, the Christian church in the UK is certainly facing a crisis. There's been a fall in congregations, you know, over a long period. Church closures. You know, you have the advance of atheism by people like Alan de Botton and other figures that are kind of threatening the church in other ways. So they've got a lot to catch up on. You'd kind of think that churches would be well informed about branding and how to get their message across. It seems they've kind of lost touch.
And it seems to me that the best people to communicate messages are branding experts, are graphic designers. And I was thinking about this beforehand. It seems that, you know, the church has often turned to architects, even in the sort of modern sense, Marcel Breuer and John Paulson, and they've modernized their buildings, but they have never seemed to have turned specifically to a really great graphic designer or a really great branding expert. Is now the time to do that? You know, if you look at a really big global brand, which is to say HSBC, has got a very strong brand. God is not just around the world, he's omnipresent. So you'd think that of all the people that needs a good branding exercise or program, it should be someone, you know, it should be religion.
Undoubtedly. But then you think about there's so many parts of the church, the Christian church. There's so many arms and legs and other bits and pieces. And they don't seem to be able to agree about very much at all, whether it's, you know, gay marriage or anything else. So whether they'd ever get around to agreeing a single corporate identity for the whole church is highly dubious. I think they've got a lot more on their plate before that happens. But what we have seen is a lot in the way of individual churches going it alone, reinventing themselves using issues and ideas that stem from their own particular circumstances and location in many cases.
Almost like a boutique hotels. We've kind of getting boutique Parish churches.
Yeah, indeed. But it is interesting, you know, you'd think the church had all the symbols, the cross, obviously, a very, very powerful symbol or logo, if you like, had the architecture.
But if we could just talk perhaps a little bit about how they go about being eye-catching, as you say, and perhaps a little bit about the language. And in your article, you mentioned that they had, you know, they used to have these sort of iconic tools, you know, the cross, you know, halos, all these things that were all, whether we're, you know, atheist or agnostic, we're all still very aware of these. How do they need to, sort of re-employ these tools? And also perhaps something about the language of the church, because again, there are so many phrases that you're familiar with, even if you don't, you know, read the Bible every day. They're just sort of slightly ingrained in society.
I mean, there's a lot of symbols associated with the church in the past, with religion. You know, obviously you have the cross, there's fishes and more recently rainbows and this kind of thing. They're all very, very hackneyed and you know, very old-fashioned. So it needs maybe a new set of symbols, but it certainly needs a new way of talking to people. And you look at any kind of modern brand that is going through that exercise now of addressing its audience in new ways, and they are thinking, you know, about verbal identity. They're thinking about the ways they speak to their audience and their tone of voice. And that is certainly something that the church needs to think about, individual churches and the way they talk in the church and outside it. It needs to have a character as well that reflects perhaps the individual identity of the church.
That was Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, a regular expert voice on Section D throughout the year. And we look forward to much more of him next year too. If you've just joined us, you're listening to a special end-of-year best of the best of 12 months of Section D. Still to come, we'll be revisiting some of the more famous names we've spoken to throughout the year, and we'll take a whistle-stop tour through the streets of Madrid, Tel Aviv and Cape Town too. But before all that, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly programme on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to the best of Section D from a year's worth of shows here on Monocle 24. Most weeks, we made it our mission to dispatch a trusted reporter onto the streets of their city to discuss the local design and architecture scene with a group of hand-picked people at the forefront of their community. It's become one of our best-loved regulars, and one of my most favourites was when Joseph Dana dropped into Cape Town to find out what the 2014 World Design Capital currently looks like.
Visiting Cape Town for the first time, one is immediately struck by two things: the staggering natural beauty of the city and the desperate social problems which plague it. South Africa has undergone a profound change in the past 20 years, but dire social issues still tax the country. From water to housing to extreme poverty, the problems facing South Africa provide designers ample opportunity to use innovation for the betterment of society.
So we come at design from a very, very strategic place. I'm not a designer, but in looking and surveying the landscape and thinking, well, what would be the levers towards enhancing our competitiveness as a nation? Clearly, creativity had to be there.
Ravi Naidu is the founder of Design Indaba, a design institution based in Cape Town, which began just after the country's transition to democracy in 1995.
Clearly, innovation has to be there, and design. And I wasn't seeing this in the national discourse. I wasn't seeing this on the national agenda. And we made it our mission to be able to put that onto the national agenda.
Cape Town has recently been selected as the World Design Capital for 2014 by the International Council for Societies of Industrial Design. The distinction gives prominence to cities that use design for their social, economic, and cultural development, and previous capitals include Torino, Seoul, and Helsinki. Sitting outside the popular Vita Cafe, architect Tsai explained his latest design project, which directly addresses one of the major problems facing Cape Town's urban core and townships. He is the director of the Tsai Design Studio, which employs his Eastern design thinking with inspiration from South Africa's diverse culture.
Shack fires in Cape Town is a huge problem. It occurs on a weekly basis, and it literally ravages thousands of shacks at one go, kills lives. So we started, a few of us designers started talking and thinking, how can we actually deal with this problem in a creative way?
There is an undeniable excitement in Cape Town concerning design these days, but questions about the quality of South African design still linger. The annual Design Indaba Expo just concluded in March with a strong showing of South African designers like Tsai that are continuing to think about design as a vehicle for social change. Ravi Naidu believes that this is why the World Design Capital is a perfect fit for Cape Town.
The World Design Capital is a great branding exercise in some respects. In some respects, it's a wonderful, smart idea of ICSID, the International Council for and Society for Industrial Designers, to offer this trophy. And what I really like is this kind of design consciousness that is emerging in the city, where politicians, civil society, businesses, schools are all engaged in this conversation about design. And I think, you know, it's always been part of our agenda, even at Design Indaba, is that we are less excited about design for consumption and more excited about design as a lever and as an instrument and as part of a toolkit to improve the quality of life.
For a country blessed with natural resources, South Africa still has a long way to go in nurturing its own design industry. The hope among many in Cape Town is that the World Design Capital Honor will help South African designers live up to the mantra, design for the other 90%. And maybe, just maybe, rekindle a national pride in South African design. For Monocle, in Cape Town, I'm Joseph Dana.
That was Joseph Dana reporting on the young design scene in Cape Town, soon to develop into a raging beast, no doubt, when it takes on the title of World Design Capital in 2014. Another design dispatch highlight for me was when Liam Aldus reported on the community in his home city of Madrid. If you thought design was tied to the economy, think again. The design community in Madrid is thriving, as Liam told us in episode 46 of Section D.
We always say that Madrid is like a big village and Barcelona is like a small city. And if you're comparing that, it's very difficult to compare one to another. Each one of the cities has their own personality. The people that live in Madrid, it's a very warm city, and for example, in terms of tourism, it's a very interesting place. It's a place where everybody loves to come. It's a very open city. It's very easy to make friends, to hang out. That's the result of that mixture of people coming from everywhere, from Spain.
We're sitting at a rooftop bar on top of Cibeles Palace. Once the city's grandiose post office, in 2011 the iconic building was reopened as Madrid's City Hall.
La ciudad ha ido cambiando, yo bajo mi punto de vista, bastante rápido. El problema que tiene un cambio rápido es que...
From my point of view, the city has been changing quite fast. The problem with rapid change is that local bars and shops suddenly began to throw off old and tired designs. And when this love of modern, cutting-edge design began, everything started changing at once. Today, people have started to appreciate what we had before. It's like a dog chasing its own tail. Tastes and trends are revamped, but what we like is also sourced from our roots.
We've just come up the elevator, paid our €3, and come up onto the rooftop terrace of El Circo de Bellas Artes in the center of Madrid. Can you tell me why rooftop terraces are becoming so important in Madrid? They're popping up everywhere.
They're very important because we have just discovered the heaven, the roof of Madrid, because traditionally we have been hiding from the sun. This is a very hot country, so what we've been doing is hiding and having not terrace but living in the interiors. From 10 or 15 years to now, even because of the non-smoking regulations, we have discovered the terraces also down in the street. But I think which is the most important is are the terraces on the top of the buildings. And what you can see is that you have a view that you're not used to of Madrid. It's a brand new view of Madrid. It's very interesting.
So do you think, you mentioned the smoking law has forced people outside a bit more and people are now enjoying the sun and the rooftop terraces. Do you think that these laws have changed the design, culture and the way we use space here in the city?
Yeah, absolutely. Business, they are developing new spaces outside. Regulations have been changing, so now it's much easier to do terrace not only during the summer, but also along the year. So this way, we are also trying to improve the restaurants and bars in Madrid.
Germán is keen to take me to a thriving example of this marriage between public space and private enterprise.
Let's go to Mercado San Antón.
We climb the stairs, resisting the delicious food stalls along the way, and arrive at our final rooftop terrace for the day, atop the San Antón Market.
So do you think it's changed the city life or the lifestyle of citizens here in Madrid for the better or for the worse?
Sí, yo creo que sí. Absolutamente cambia el estilo de Madrid. Primero porque en este caso...
Yes, I think so. Absolutely. Because in this case, it was a novel idea. Before the market existed, the Mercado de San Miguel, also a public space, was converted into a typical Spanish food market. It wasn't working as a traditional market, and so it was reinterpreted and was a success. Being a success, people are using it, and of course, it improves the city's quality of life. Where we are now, you're right in the city center, and by taking an elevator up to the top floor, you're surrounded by beautiful people, a friendly environment, and modern design, which also maintains cultural aspects of tapas bars in Spain.
Well, it seems the waiter just arrived and he's just serving up our drink, so maybe we should cheers each other and just have a nice refreshing drink on this hot day.
Salud.
Salud, hombre, salud.
That was Liam Aldus reporting on the design community of Madrid there for episode 46 of Section D. Remember, if you'd like to hear any, and perhaps every, one of these shows in full, visit monocle.com. Or visit iTunes and type Section D into the search. They'll all be there in full. Throughout the year, we've sought to champion the smaller, unheard voices making a big difference across the many disciplines we call design. But every now and then, we headed for the big guns too. I admit I was a little starstruck when I knocked on Richard Rogers' office door for episode 17, but he couldn't have been more charming. You have a real talent for talking about architecture in very human terms, which is something that most architects lack. Is this something that you've sort of developed over the course of your career?
I certainly came as much into it as much on the political social side as I did from the art side, shall we say. So I suppose it does come up really natural to me. And the fact that I love cities, and I was born in a wonderful city-state being Florence, you know, and London's fantastic, and so that does drive you to realise the interrelationship between space and people.
But another point that you made in the talk, which I was interested by, was the fact that you said architects don't have a place at the table for...
Yes,
in
that's
governments.
Way of putting it.
And you've been very vocal about how important architects are in shaping...
One's environment.
One's
yeah.
environment.
I think it may be because, first of all, architects tend to concentrate on the more on the design side towards the beauty side, and I'm all for beauty. I'm not on the marriage between science and art, shall we say. And as far as politicians are concerned, they wouldn't have a clue when they get into the art side. So why do they want architects if they keep on concentrating and if they believe they concentrate? Not helped by the fact that the profession underlines this in a way by either doing very rather boring, sort of very technical studies, or doing art, but seldom marrying the two. And I think this is, and that, as I said in my talk, I believe architecture should actually is the mother of arts, and that there should be a sort of general course, which is architecture, three-dimensional architecture, 3 to 5 years, and then you should specialize in doing, whether it's planning or engineering, urban engineering, or whether it's landscape or what else.
So do you see it as a failing of the architecture industry then, that they haven't managed to translate the importance of what they do to the general public or policymakers?
I mean, no profession has got it right totally, let's put it that way. In the area that I was talking about then is that if I think architecture is political. There's no way you can avoid it. You can have to get planning permission to start with. You're dealing with cities, which are a very political situation. You know, the ghettos which we build, be they the rich or the poor, more or less dictate or are part of the political situation, which are either brutal, which creates certain reactions to people. As you go into the poorer areas, people either vote extreme left or extreme right. And that's, you know, it creates poles. And that has its own problems. So it's very political. What it does to people is political. Politicians don't tend to recognise that.
You're endlessly vocal about your passion for cities and city life. So would it be hell for you to move to the countryside?
No, I enjoy all the more. The weekends I get away, not many. And I go and stay with one of my sons usually. We had a weekend house. And I love going. I spend a month in the summer in South Tuscany, actually in the countryside, beautiful valley and so on. So one of my points is that if you design what I believe you should, or if you develop a compact city, then you have a countryside. If you don't, you just have a sprawl. And it's amazing how quickly you destroy the view. And there's nothing more exciting than going to see the rolling downs or the rolling hills or the lakes or the sea. But if you've got little houses or whatever it is, are spotted all over, you've lost it. So my point is, it's two sides of the same coin, and we have to be as defensive of both.
That was Richard Rogers there on episode 17 of Section D. Fast forward a few weeks, and Monocle's senior editor was tapping on the studio door of another great name in the world of design. Sir James Dyson has stuck his neck out a lot over the past few years, a spokesman in the UK and around the world for promoting industry, innovation, copyright laws, and investment in design education, to name just a few of the causes he's championed. Sophie Grove sat down with him for episode 29 of Section D.
Well, what's always excited me and what I'm passionate about now is developing technology that solves a problem and then engineering it into a product that works better, gives better performance, is lighter, and uses less energy, and so on. So that's what excites me, and I think that's what good design is. I mean, you tend to think that good design is something which looks good. And of course, that's important, but it should be part of something that works better. In building my vacuum cleaner, I made 5,126 failures before I got one that worked. And so that understanding that failure is exciting and stimulating and creative is really important. And I've had business failures. You know, when I developed my vacuum cleaner, I thought that the world's big electronics manufacturers would be interested in making it, but none of them were interested in making it. I got quite slightly angry, but also I saw an opportunity. You know, if none of them were interested in making something that didn't use bags and didn't have the loss of suction problems in bags, I should do it. That maybe I would succeed if they're not innovating and not developing technology and not moving forwards. I could do that, and people might be interested.
How do you think this country sort of can reinvigorate its manufacturing industries and sort of boost the status of making things again?
We have wonderful science and engineering research going on in British universities. We don't produce very many engineers and scientists, but what we do is really high quality. We got lots of really good designers coming out of our design universities. We have the Royal College of Art, which is a fantastic postgraduate and the best art college in the world, design college in the world. So we got all the wherewithal, but what's missing is this link with manufacturing. We completely disassociate design and engineering and technology from manufacturing. And manufacturing is the wealth-creating part. The world wants new technology and new products. And we've got the design, we've got the technology, but we don't seem to want to be bothered to make it, do the dirty business of making something. And it's not a dirty business. It's a very, very exciting and creative business, I can tell you. I mean, we make hundreds of thousands of things every day, and it's fascinating and very, very exciting.
And can I ask you about the sort of frontier, if you put your sci-fi hat on and look at some of the innovations that you expect to see in the next 20 or 30 years, what are your predictions?
Oh, well, no, that's secret. If I had any, I'd keep them to myself or to ourselves. No, I think that there are going to be really interesting developments in materials. I think material science hasn't advanced very much, but you can now see carbon nanotubes and, of course, everybody's seen carbon fiber, which is quite a revolution, and graphene and things like that. So I think materials will move forward, which is really interesting because we can use less energy and make products lighter by advancing the science of materials. And I think there will be, and the new materials will also lead to other interesting developments. For example, copper is a bit old-fashioned and archaic to be using so much copper in products. So I think we'll see a move away from those old-fashioned materials to something more exotic, like carbon nanotubes.
I'm quite excited about the Android vacuum cleaner. That's purely for the lazy houseworkers amongst us. Is that something we're going to see in the next couple of years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, much better robotic vacuum cleaners are a thing of the future, of course.
That was Sir James Dyson on Section D, Episode 29. We've also had a lot of fun on Section D. One of my favourite folk in the design world is author, curator, critic and irreverent character Stephen Bailey. Bailey's latest book, Ugly, celebrates the importance of imperfection in a world obsessed with flawlessness. Hazel Pfeiffer quizzed him on the topic at his book launch for Episode 52 back in September.
I've got a professional, lifelong personal interest in design. I've always been interested in the appearance of things. I'm obsessed by the appearance of things. I mean, I'm more interested in the appearance of things than anything else. I've always wanted to know what things mean, whether it's a building, a car, a woman, whatever. And I've always, even as a child, before I knew what aesthetics was, I'm not sure I know what aesthetics is now, but I've always wanted to hold up the material world to scrutiny. I've always wanted to ask questions about, you know, why do we admire the look of a Ferrari but not admire the look of a Vauxhall or a Peugeot? I don't know. I was asking questions like that all the time. And then, of course, I became professionally involved with the whole world of design. And one of the great things which designers, or the whole design world, likes to talk about is, until recently it did, about how to democratize, you know, beauty. The whole thrust of 20th century design was how to make beauty universal. And this is a noble and fascinating idea. But as soon as you begin to examine it, you begin to ask questions. I mean, what is this idea of beauty? And if you begin to scrutinize the idea of beauty, you inevitably come around to the unspoken idea of ugliness. Now, ugliness is just absolutely fascinating, not least because no one's really, before my book, I mean, quite seriously, almost no one has bothered to address it. I mean, how do you cope with the idea? I mean our civilization is based on notions of beauty, but how do you address ugliness? And, you know, this book it's a sort of jeu d'esprit. It's not an academic book. You can't write an academic book. There are no other books on ugliness. It's a sort of intellectual entertainment. I just want people to ask questions. I mean, what is ugliness? What does it mean? What do we mean by it? You know, what are the conventions of beauty? You know, we're always told things must be beautiful. We want to get more beautiful. You want to get a tan. I want to lose weight. We want to have a nicer house, a better car. We go to the gym. All these things to make ourselves more beautiful. But the fact is, if everything was beautiful, nothing would be. I mean, a world of beauty would be bland, uniform, and actually intolerable. Accept that idea, and it therefore follows that we need a little bit of ugliness. You need ugliness in order to excite the appetite for beauty. I mean, heaven needs hell. You can't have a concept of heaven unless you've got a concept of hell at the same time. But equally, accept that argument, and you have to accept the following proposition that, well, ask the following question: exactly how much ugliness do we need? I mean, should there be laws to promote ugliness? Should there be quotas? Should we how do we promote ugliness? How do we create more? Because it's absolutely certain we need a certain ugliness in order to enjoy beauty.
So if beauty is homogenizing, then ugliness is difference.
Yeah. There's more variety. I believe there's more variety in ugliness. I mean, I think there's probably only one sort of beauty, perhaps. But I think ugliness is, it's one of the many ways in which ugliness could be, you could argue that ugliness is superior to beauty, because you can do it in so many ways. We get the word ugliness from the old Norse word ugga, which means aggressive. That's why we talk of an ugly customer, an ugly noise. It's something which is intrusive and challenging. I love that line of Serge Gainsbourg, the French chanteur, crooner, who said ugliness is superior to beauty because it lasts longer. And it's true, beauty, the reason why beauty is so affecting and so tragic is because it's evanescent, it passes in people and places. And again, that's one of the other, I think, whether it's an important idea, it's certainly a fascinating one in the book, that one of the only things certain about human affairs is that our tastes change. What's conventionally regarded as beautiful in one generation, we absolutely certain is not regarded as beautiful in the next. It's worth asking this question. I mean, what are the conventions of beauty? What are the conventions of ugliness?
Do we need an ugly revolution?
I think we need to be more aware of it. I think what we don't want is complacency, because as I say, notions of beauty continuously change, but we wouldn't want the whole world to be beautiful, because that would be very, very boring.
That was Stephen Bailey waxing lyrical on the topic of ugliness for Section D, Episode 52. We're almost at the end of our end-of-year best-of special edition of Section D. Time to round things off with my absolute favourite package of the year. A tough choice to choose from the 300 or so packages we've played. But after careful deliberation, I settled for Joseph Dana's thought-provoking dip into the crumbling Bauhaus legacy in Tel Aviv. A report he delivered for episode 30 to coincide with the Bauhaus exhibition, which opened in May at London's Barbican.
Form follows function. This overused mantra is all too often associated with the Steve Jobs approach to personal computing, but it has its roots in a revolutionary design movement led by Walter Gropius called Bauhaus. Born in the idyllic German town of Weimar in 1919, the greatest collection of Bauhaus architecture can somewhat ironically be found on the sun-drenched streets of Tel Aviv.
The Bauhaus architecture is not a style which you look at it and it's overwhelming, but it is very functional. It's very clear lines, very simple.
Mika Gross is the co-director of the Bauhaus Center in Tel Aviv, which has been running tours and promoting the architectural style for 12 years.
So you just have to know more about it to appreciate it, and I think that's a task of education, to explain to the people what is the revolutionary part of the Bauhaus architecture within the history of architecture.
Similar to the Art Nouveau of Klimt's turn of the century Vienna, Bauhaus was founded with the idea of creating a total work of art, one which would invariably include architecture. The approach was function above all else, and a perfect fit for a newly forming Israeli state, comprised of immigrants pouring in from all corners of the globe and attempting to create an entirely new society. As you walk around the city of Tel Aviv, the Bauhaus in international style is all-consuming, so much so that it is difficult to notice how engrossing the surroundings actually are until you take a moment to stop and register the straight lines and simple functionality of the buildings. For Jeremy Hoffman, the head of the conservation department at the city of Tel Aviv, Bauhaus is a contribution to the history and progress of mankind.
I'm very proud of. I think it's a part of the communal history, as UNESCO declared it, is a part not only of the history of the city or the country, is a part of the evolution of mankind in the 20th century. It represents something very important. We see it as a part also as the evolution that afterwards became the evolution of the 50s and 60s and 70s, that we are under reorganization or rethinking about this architecture. And I think these footsteps, starting from 1909, the first architecture, the Arab-Palestinian architecture in Tel Aviv, altogether make the story of the city.
Tel Aviv's Bauhaus Center runs popular Friday afternoon walking tours of the city's architecture. Michal Minsky is one of the walking guides. On this particular tour, Spanish, French, English, and German were freely spoken as the tour group meandered around the decaying Bauhaus buildings of central Tel Aviv.
Before we start, I'd like you to see an example for a renovated building, because most of the buildings we'll see on the tour will be quite neglected and deteriorated. And even though there is a renovation tendency, still most of the houses are not renovated.
Despite its role in the creation of Israel and international recognition, Tel Aviv's Bauhaus is facing a challenge, perhaps its greatest, because of decay and neglect. As rents skyrocket and new buildings are created to help alleviate the residential congestion, the city is working hard to preserve its Bauhaus legacy, which includes over 4,000 buildings. A new generation of Israelis are less interested in the historical importance of Bauhaus and more interested in cheap rent. Jeremy Hoffman.
The site, Tel Aviv Bauhaus site, was declared by UNESCO in 2003. Since then, we have a general conservation plan regarding 1,000 buildings, in which 200 are in restrictions, which means changes are not allowed, and we have to protect them as unique international style houses. The others are changeable. It means that we have to conserve them as they are, but we are allowing changes, additions on the roofs in order to enable the city to grow and change and to have the financial means for the protections of the buildings.
But what if Tel Aviv's Bauhaus has run its course? What if it no longer suits the needs of Tel Aviv and has lost its raison d'etre of functionality? Back in the comfortable office of Micha Gross, he informs me that one of the great Bauhaus architects recommended an unusual solution to the problem of decay in Tel Aviv. A solution, it should be noted, which is truly Bauhaus in approach.
We had discussions with one of the last in this year still living Bauhaus architects, Mistechkin, and he told us we were going to interview him, and he said, listen, Bauhaus architecture, the main reason of it is the functionalism. And I think it was functional 80 years ago when we constructed the buildings in the international style, but today there is better architecture, and I would suppose that it would be more functional to destroy all the Bauhaus buildings and to leave just one or two as an example for the coming generations.
Functionalist Bauhaus architecture came out of an experimental relationship to modernism in the early 20th century. The city of Tel Aviv, a modern European city in the heart of the Middle East, is also a product of this bold period of change. Understood as an architectural treasure, a tourist attraction, and a World Heritage Site, Tel Aviv's Bauhaus is a profoundly vibrant monument to modernism. Its slow decay is yet another reminder of our increasingly growing disinterest with the modernist foundations of contemporary society.
And that brings us to the end of this special Best of 2012 on Section D. What a year it's been. But fear not, 2013 is shaping up to deliver every bit as much material, travels, analysis, voices, and chairs as 2012. We'll be back on January the 1st with a look ahead of the year to come, so grab a glass of something fizzy and join us then to celebrate the new year. You can hear all of the shows we featured today in full by visiting monocle.com or downloading Section D from iTunes. In the meantime, all that's left is to thank our indomitable producer Gillian Tobias and editor Holly Fisher, and the special editor for this Best Of show, Toby Hammond. I've been Hugo MacDonald. Thank you all for tuning in, and have a wonderful holiday season. Goodbye.